Welcome back, folks, to the Street Pro Podcast. Chris Versace here, and as you know, we love to dig deep into the well of talent that you can find over at the Street Pro. Recent guests have included Carly Gardner, Helene Meisler, and today I'm very excited to bring on the man who brings you the Morning Recon every morning, as well as a lot of insight in and around various positions with his thoughts, again, which you can only catch here at the Street Pro, the one, Stephen Sarge Guilfoyle.
It is I.
Oh, Sarge, how are you doing in this market?
Well, you know, it's gotten a little tougher to make money on a day-to-day basis, I think, of late. But, you know, trying to stay with my themes anyway. We had an outstanding year last year, but we can't live on that for 2 years. And beginning to this year too, but you know, I think as we go into the middle part of the year, I think we're going to have to learn how to multitask and while staying invested, we might have to do a little day trading or week trading or whatever your version of short term trading is, because I think we're going to have to churn a little to make some money.
I think the bob and weave is what you're talking about.
Yeah, bobbing and weaving, weaving and bobbing.
Okay. So. You know, we're here as we talk today. The market traded off yesterday, Monday, April 1st. Today is April 2nd. It has moved lower. A couple things going on. You know, the 10-year Treasury yields moved higher. We saw through the March manufacturing PMI that, oh, not only is manufacturing coming back, so too is inflation. People are starting to go, oh, my hair is on fire. We may not get those 3 rate cuts. It might be 2, might be 1, might be none. And I think there's this big rethink going on. At the same time, Helene Meisler has been very vocal about the market really trading, and you even alluded to this before we started rolling, in a narrow channel that looks to be challenged potentially. Are you surprised by all these things?
I'll tell you what surprised me, because as anybody who follows me knows, I have been kind of a naysayer on the quality of the economic recovery. The quality of the last 2 GDP reports is valid. It's valid because GDI made a comeback. GDI, the last 6 months or so, has actually, well, Q3 and Q4, actually printed equal to or slightly above as to Q4 above GDP. So it validated the economic activity they were measuring for. Something like 6 of the 7 quarters prior to that, GDI printed way below GDP, actually in recessionary territory for a lot of that. And for folks who don't know, GDI should equal GDP. They should be a check upon one another. So when folks on television, you know, economists or politicians, whoever, were telling you how strong economic activity was because of how rapid GDP was growing, they were being dishonest, either ignorant or dishonest, because every good economist knows when GDI and GDP don't square with each other, you have to average the two. You don't just go with the higher number because it smells better. And that's what they did for a long time.
So 2 things. One, you know, most folks, I think, know GDP, gross disposable product, GDI, Sarge, for the lay listener here.
Gross domestic income.
Thank you.
I mean, it's basically one. They tally all the same economic activity, but from different perspectives. So let's say it's the seller adding up how much he sells and the buyer adding up how much they bought, and they only trade with each other. They should come to the same number.
Would you say that it is insightful the way it is to peer through the twin lenses that we get with each employment report?
I think the employment reports have been extremely unreliable. So I don't know.
I'm referring to, you know, there's always 2 different sets of data, right, in the employment report. There's the household survey, and then there's the other data that we get. And, you know, I don't like to hang my hat on any one particular data point or one particular report. I always look to triangulate. Does comparing the GDP and the GDI give you that type of triangulation, yes or no?
I think it alludes to the fact that the economy is growing. I don't see the consistent strength in the labor market that we're supposed to be seeing, because, as you mentioned, the establishment report has been strong. But again, they jigger it down the next 2 months every single time. So how strong is it really? And we know that most of the gains for the past year have been part-time jobs. Meanwhile, the household number has completely disagreed with the establishment number, and the ADP number has completely disagreed. They've both been much weaker than the establishment number. And most professional economists included in the consensus view have agreed with the weaker numbers, not the stronger numbers. So the only one sticking out there like a sore thumb is the strong number, which has been the non-farm payrolls number. Again, I think that's dishonest when politicians and or folks, pundits on television come on and tell you, oh, look, 385,000 jobs were created. Oh, that's awesome. In 2 months, it'll be 195. You know?
Yeah, it's a lot like the GDP revisions. You know, you'd like to think that the first number is the right number. Rarely is it.
And it's always revised lower. So there's something wrong with the way they're doing it, with the way they add it up.
Okay. But you were saying that you're incrementally bullish on the economy because GDI is
strong right now. The last 6 months of 2023 were strong. So the real looking snapshot was strong. I don't know how we go into Q1 should probably be another decent quarter, mm-hmm. but I don't know how we go into the later part of the year because I know you fret about this as I do. I think the fiscal picture is so bad. It's so imbalanced. And I believe the Federal Reserve, the FOMC, they're now in a corner now because now we have inflation stronger than we want it. And we have an economy that's coming off 6 months that was stronger than they probably wanted it. So you can't cut. If you have a conscience, you can't cut interest rates right now. So they're in a box.
Totally agree. You know, I was chatting with someone about this and they're like, well, why can't they? I'm like, look, if rates are restrictive, right, and the economy is growing and inflation is coming back, as we saw in the last 3 months of data, you know, if they cut rates, yeah, they will turbocharge the economy and turbocharge, that's the risk, inflation, undoing the progress that they've made. So they certainly can't do that. But, you know, what do you think? Do we even get a rate cut this year?
If I'm on the FOMC, I can't say for sure. I mean, there could always be some kind of catastrophe that comes up or a crisis. Mm-hmm. But right now, my view would be that we if I'm sitting on that committee, we probably cannot raise rates or cut rates, I should say, for the rest of the year. And I would actually, that slipped into my verbiage there, because I would actually be toying with raising rates 25 basis points at some point if what we're seeing does not change, because clearly rates are not restrictive enough.
Agreed. I mean, look, as people who read what I write for the portfolio and listen to the podcast know, I am extremely data dependent. my thinking early in the year was maybe we certainly don't get six, maybe we get two or three rate cuts. I'm inclined to think that's somewhere between one and two. But as we go through the second quarter, we'll have a much better sense of how sticky this inflation is. And as I update my thinking, that potential one to two could go to zero to one, maybe even zero. So we'll have to see. But I don't think, you know, the thing that concerns me about the second half of the year, since you brought it up, is that if we don't see a lot of progress in the near term, then we're going to see the timing for these rate cuts slip out till after the election. Because I honestly think that if the Fed doesn't move before July, before or at its July meeting, it is not going to move ahead of the election, especially this election.
I would even say June, but July is the latest they can move without being accused of being political. And you know what? If they do cut rates, and we still have a GDP and GDI that are telling a nice story, and we still have inflation that's running a little bit too hot, then we know for a fact that they are indeed no longer independent.
True. I wasn't going to go down that path, but it's hard to disagree with that line of thinking. So we will see. Although I will say, I usually don't talk politics, but man, what a set of horrible choices this time around. Holy cow.
It really horrible is. I don't like to talk politics either. In fact, I rarely do it in my columns or anything. I try to stick only to the making of money or the interpretation of economics. But really, I mean, when you look at these three guys, because it's three, even a one guy make it no electoral votes, he may take a chunk of the popular vote and impact the election. If you look at these three guys and you're like, you know what? I think even though I disagree with number three on a lot of his issues, he seems like the most common sense guy of the three.
which is why he won't get the big backing and he won't win. I hate to say that, but that's probably the case. The thing that really struck me, it happened, I guess, a couple days ago. Obama, Biden, and Clinton did a fundraiser, and I didn't watch or participate or anything, but I did see a picture of the three of them together, and I was just thinking about this, that Clinton is younger than Biden, and Clinton was president how long ago?
Right. Yeah.
It's crazy.
I guess he left in 2000, right? So
from
93 to 2000, from January 93 to January 2001, that was his term, right?
Yeah. So, and he's younger than Biden.
and you know what? Age isn't the thing, though. Age. I don't want to be ageist because I may be an old man trying to hold down a job someday. So but I do think that when there's, I mean, I'm going to sound political here, and I'm not trying to, but when it's obvious, undeniable, something going on there in terms of rapidly declining cognition, yeah. I don't know what you want to call it, then you do have to really take a second look and say, okay, you know what? Even if you agree with the man's policies, you have to move on to whoever is the backup quarterback. I mean, you can't go with this.
I will say that close to Biden's age, we did not trust my dad with the TV remote, nor did we give him car keys. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Yeah, my mom's the same age as Joe, and she doesn't drive anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, well, on the other hand, I don't think Joe drives either, but that's neither here nor there.
He probably does not. You're probably right about that.
All right. So let's talk about an event that's coming up soon. Yes, we have a lot of economic data coming up, but you know, when we closed out the March quarter, if we looked at the multiple for the S&P 500, it was pretty lofty on 2024 consensus expectations, at least relative to where it's been the last few years. And again, if you look at the longer 20-year average. So I wrote that I really think that the March quarter earnings season, not so much the actual results for the March quarter, but the guidance is going to be extremely important. We need to see if that, you know, 10.5% EPS growth for the S&P 500 in 2024 has any upside. Because you know as well as I do, Sarge, right? If PEs are extended, they're not likely to get much more juice out of that. You need to see the earnings number come up. P times E or PE times E gives you the stock price, or in this case, the S&P 500 price. So are you concerned at all about the April quarter earnings season?
I am concerned about the guidance myself as well. I think 10.5, 11 times, whatever the full year guidance is, I think it's awfully aggressive. I think it's going to be hard to meet. And when they start disappointing overall, I don't think we ever have where the majority of them disappoint, because they'll ratchet down those expectations so that they don't disappoint. But right. But when we get down the road and it turns out to be 8% and not 11%, then, or 7%, something like that, then they're going to have to reprice the marketplace. And, you know, they may do it gradually where it's not a, you know, an overnight beatdown. But unless those earnings can grow into their expectations and grow into their, what is it, 20.9 times multiple or whatever it is right now, then the market has to take a step back. And it's the market's due for a step back. The market, I mean, you were talking about Helene's price channels. I mean, they look ridiculous. One, it's a proof of algorithmic trading dominating human trading, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which is unfortunate because I'm a human trader. I don't know how anything can go in such perfectly straight and narrow lines up for months and months and months, constantly bouncing off of resistance and support at almost precisely where they're supposed to. So it's almost as if we're the ping pong ball and the big guys are just playing ping pong with us.
Right. But you did post a chart on Twitter, and I joked about this earlier with you. The only thing you wrote was, uh-oh, SpaghettiOs. And it was a chart of the NASDAQ composite potentially breaking that lower support level.
Yeah, the NASDAQ composite did crack the lower rising trend line of that channel today. It gapped down a little bit. It hasn't retaken it yet. It's below the 21-day simple moving average, which in theory turns some of the swing trading crowd against the market. And I don't know how many of those guys are still out there. But there is support. I mean, there is support around 15.9 and change where the 50-day simple moving average is. So you do have the cavalry. That's where supposedly the professional money lives. They would come to the charge, but that would change the complexion of the chart. It would broaden the channel for one. And that lower trend line that we're speaking of could become resistance. So, unless this is reversed somehow by the end of the day or by tomorrow or something like that. I mean, we do have a lot of key macroeconomic events going on this week with the jobs report and early next week with the CPI. So I guess they have days to recover this chart, but if it goes unrecovered, then it will obviously change the shape of technical analysis for the next go round.
So just getting back to what we were talking about in terms of the March quarter earnings, you know, one other catalyst that we didn't talk about that could challenge it is if all of a sudden negative pre-announcements happen. Because, you know, you take a look at PVH, branded apparel company, Calvin Klein, Tommy Hilfiger, they posted a good January quarter number earlier this week, but their guidance was horrible, especially for EPS guidance. And the stock got, you know, tomahawked. It was down, I think, you know, 15-16% at one point. You know, that resetting of expectations lower, that could challenge things.
Well, we know the consumer is in over their heads as far as credit goes. We know that a higher percentage than usual are in over their head as far as servicing that credit goes. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a high-end consumer. Well, not even, because that's kind of a high-end brand, right? Borderline. So maybe there's a ratcheting down of what consumers are comfortable handling. Maybe the low-end consumer is almost out of the game. Maybe the middle-class consumer is thinking they're more towards the low end now. Maybe the upper-middle-class consumer is thinking they're really more like middle-class now. So maybe we heard what the McDonald's CEO said in his conference call after earnings last time, right? McDonald's felt they were pricing out the low-end consumer. Well, that's their base. So that's truly problematic going forward. Usually when it's also a sign of the economy going into a tougher period. I usually invest in the dollar stores and TJ Maxx and those kinds of stores. I'm still long TJ, by the way. But I usually get involved in those names when I think the economy is going to go into a tougher period. And McDonald's is kind of like the food version of those names. Mm-hmm. And so if that means dollar stores and TJ Maxx and Ross stores and those kinds of retailers are going to be accidentally pricing out their base by extension. I don't want to get it, you know, sound like I'm panicking, but it's certainly something we have to worry about as we traverse the rest of this year. I don't think I have the right answer just yet.
Well, you know, we have liked McDonald's as a trade down from casual dining just because of food inflation and some of the consumer factors that you had talked about. You know, the domestic business appears to be performing better. There is some disruption out on the international channels, and I think they commented not too long ago that China was a little slower than expected. But we are seeing some of the more recent data from China start to perk up. We'll have to see and continue to monitor that. But I agree with you. You know, we've been very the only real consumer plays that we have in the portfolio are McDonald's, which I just talked about, PepsiCo, Costco, which is an absolute beast, and Amazon, which is doing extremely well of late. And I wouldn't be surprised if their big spring sale helps them sail past consensus expectations for the March quarter.
Yeah, I'm in Amazon as well. I still have a tech dominant portfolio for the most part, and Amazon is one of my software / enterprise AI data analytical group. I kind of like made.
Wow, you checked a lot of boxes there.
Well, because a lot of these firms are evolving so fast that I used to put them into little pockets to make sure I was diversified across technology, but really, the semis are the only ones that are still the semis. The software evolved into so many different things now.
So I, you know, that is true. But, you know, it's funny. That's true and it's not true, right? Because you take a company like Qualcomm, very different than NVIDIA, very different than Intel, right? And then you look at some of the RF semiconductors, very different than all of those. So there are certain differentiated end markets, I would argue. You don't see Qualcomm going into data center, for example. You don't see Skyworks going into data center. So I do think you need to understand the markets that each of these chip companies play in. But the other funny thing is there have been some times where people, you know, and I'm sure they don't mean to, but they will lump companies like Applied Materials into chips. And that's as you know, a company that makes the machines.
Right.
That makes the chips.
Their competitors different, are Lam totally Research different. And KLA
yeah,
Tencor.
Correct, you know. correct. So, I mean, I always stress that you got to know what you own and why you own it. You know what I mean? But that's just my thing on chips. But I also agree with you that, you know, you are seeing these companies really start to blur lines, you know, as more try to lean into or reposition their businesses into, you know, growthier end markets. And of course, everybody is talking about AI. And in fact, I think in the last 2 weeks, there was a company that pulled a trick from the dot-com era where it not only renamed itself something dot AI, they changed their investor relations website to, you know, the revised name dot AI as well. You know, just one of those things to throw out there.
Well, look at NVIDIA, right? They're getting into software now. Meanwhile, Amazon and Alphabet and those names are trying to build their own semiconductors. So they really are trying to, because things are so expensive, because services and hardware are so expensive now, they're all trying to bring everything in-house. But it's so hard to do, and then you end up having to hire a foundry because they can't build them. So
a foundry, there's only two.
Well,
right,
TSM
and Global Foundries, exactly right.
And then Intel's in that game. They want to be. I mean,
yeah, we'll see about that. It's kind of, you know, it's hard on the one hand for them to go out, and I always thought when they talked about the foundry business, it was really to drive the capacity utilization levels higher, because they were at the point where they made that announcement that were losing out to, you know, NVIDIA, AMD, Marvell, and others.
Well, they got their tail kicked in everything they competed. I mean,
yep.
AMD took the PCs away from them, and NVIDIA took the AI away from them, and Marvell is breathing down their necks and everything. I mean, In fact, are you still long Marvell? You are, right?
We are. We the portfolio is long Marvell, yes. And we actually, in the last 2 weeks, upgraded it to a one on the most recent pullback. We rounded out our position, which our timing, you know, as people often say, I'd rather be lucky than right. Fortunately, we were both. So that was actually a good pickup.
They got a nice compliment yesterday from the analyst over at Bank of America. His name escapes me, but he was naming AI names you might not have thought of yet that he thinks will do well, and so Marvell was one of them.
So I think there's a direct and indirect play for AI, right, at Marvell. So there is what's unfolding in the data center piece, right? But my thinking is that almost any time we've had some of these new technologies, we see an explosion in what I call the virtuous data circle. And what I mean by that is, an explosion in the amount of data that is consumed and created. And AI is going to do that on steroids, especially once we start to see AI on device. And that's PCs, tablets, smartphones. And we're going to start seeing that happen probably in the back half of this year. We've had announcements from Dell already, HP, and I'm sure smartphones are coming. Just wait for Apple's event. But here's the thing. Once that data explosion happens, right, we're going to have to add even more to data center. We're going to have to drive incremental capacity in the networks and at carrier infrastructure. Those are Marvell's two other big businesses. So when they talked about their guidance, when they reported their quarter, you know, they gave very positive guidance for data center. They talked about near-term weakness network and carrier infrastructure, but they said, we see a rebound in the back half of the year. And if you line those pieces up that I described, maybe it's the back half of the year, maybe it's a quarter later than that. But if AI on device takes off, that business is going to ramp.
And it's big for memory too. Micron and Western Digital have gone from like the paupers of the semi space So suddenly they're going to be the fat kids latter half of the year, I think. They won't be able to fill orders.
Well, I think you're right, because I think most people are focused on the chips that are going to be used for AI, but you've got to think about the other system requirements around it. And just to connect the piece that I said about Marvell, what the implications are, right? And I think that full 360, I don't know if it's 360, 720, spinning on a different axis, whatever, but that's the way that we've got to think about things. You know, you know what it is? It's like Star Trek with Spock and Kirk playing three-dimensional chess. That's the way we need to think about it. We can't afford to play checkers.
We should play three-dimensional chess. We should get one of those boards.
All right. So we talked about a bunch of different stocks, but I also want to talk about some others that you've been a little vocal about, Sarge. In particular, today over at Real Money Pro, you made a comment that GE Aerospace is the place to be in GE. And I don't want to ask you this because I know that you have an affinity for, a fondness for the defense names, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics. Is this a twist on that, or is this something else?
It could be. You're a fool if you don't recognize your own biases. So, there could be an attraction there that it's almost always my largest space within the industrials is my exposure to defense. So there has to be more than just rational thinking there. So I am disposed to invest in those names and see them in a positive light. Lockheed Martin's been doing wonderfully of late, by the way, but so not the other, and so has General Dynamics, but the others have not been doing quite so well. And I think that might be a play on the recent success of one of their hypersonic missiles that supposedly wasn't going to go into production, just had a successful test. And the fact that Japan is ramping up their military in preparation, not for a war with China, but to be able to defend themselves better against China. And that means F-35s. So,
well, and don't forget two other things. You know, it looks like some of the Western European NATO countries are going to have to ratchet their budgets higher. But you are right, though. You just said something with, you mentioned that the buzzword for Lockheed, F-35.
Yeah, F-35s. Right?
That is the big catalyst we're waiting for that production to resume.
And General Dynamics is tanks and submarines and some shoulder fired missiles. So that's another reason why they're doing so well. But right, Northrop Grumman's kind of disappointing. I mean, lately, I own them, but they haven't really done anything. And they do. Go ahead.
Bring me back to GE Aerospace.
Oh, okay. When it comes to that one. I wasn't in GE Healthcare all this time, and it went up nicely. So I'm not always right about these names, because I really did not think GE Healthcare was a good name to invest in at the time. Now that they're splitting apart, yes, there is a case to believe that sales and free cash flow can improve over the shorter term, over the medium to longer term for GE Verona. Vernova, am I saying that right?
Vernova. I think so.
But let's face it, aerospace is the cash cow of that business. Larry Culp is staying on as the chairman and CEO at the one he thinks is going to do the best for it. That's plain as day. They make the engines for both Airbus and Boeing on the civilian side, which might not be that good. It's usually a pretty sweet deal to have those two in your corner. But right now, who knows? Maybe that Brazilian company will supersede, or maybe not supersede those two, but become a third player because of the weaknesses in Airbus's business and because of the obvious high level of incompetence at Boeing's management level.
Any interest in that, or is it just got to stay on the sideline?
You know, have you ever read when I talk about what that Air Force staff sergeant told me back in whatever year it was?
Let's just say I politely forgot.
Okay. Well, way back when we were on our, when the Air Force was giving us a lift down to Panama, I got into a conversation. I think I was a corporal at the time with a staff sergeant in the Air Force, and he was muttering and cursing at something. And he just hated Boeing. He hated Boeing because they make his life harder. And he just told me, he said, flat out, everything we get from these guys, he goes, it's dirty. It looks like it's used when it's new. He said, all the other contractors, it's wonderful when you get something new. something you get from Boeing, you got to clean it and fix it yourself. And I was like, wow. And that's over 40 years ago, or whatever, about 40 years ago. And I just, it stuck with me my whole life. When I thought of Boeing, I thought of an inferior product compared to the other defense contractors in my head. As a low-ranking enlisted man, what a staff sergeant had told me one day in 1980, whatever, as I was loading onto a plane.
You know what? You may have missed a lot of turbulence as a result.
I know, because for a guy who's usually in defense names, right, I was never in VA. So that staff sergeant, you know, doing his job back then, probably got me out of some trouble in the modern day.
So you're thinking GE Aerospace, if Airbus picks up some share, engine share from Boeing, maybe it's a beneficiary. Fair to say?
It could be. And that, I forget the name of that Brazilian company right now, the third player in the civilian jetliner space. They're getting orders they never got before because people are looking for an alternative.
Okay.
I can't remember the name of that company. I wouldn't be able to pull it out of thin air. I'm not a shareholder, obviously. But there is a third player. There's an up-and-coming third player in the space.
Okay. And one other one I want to touch on is Todd Campbell, former editor of Street Smarts and a wonderful human being and doing a lot of great things over at the Street on the free site these days. I think he gave you a shout out for being an early bull on Palantir.
Yeah, he did.
you posted a chart of Palantir. And it looks like, I'm just kind of eyeballing it, that it's kind of traded off over the last, you know, couple weeks, call it, you know, four or five weeks. And you're looking to increase your position. You mentioned this right before we started taping. Why do you like Palantir so much? What separates it from a lot of others?
I think they're the best in the business when it comes to data and big data analytics and in the government / intelligence type space. So I think as far as artificial intelligence goes, I think there are, I won't say light years ahead of everyone else, but they're ahead of everyone else. I think this is a stock that, though it trades in the 20s, I think, and it might come in a little bit here. I mean, technically speaking, it's testing a 22 pivot right now. It does look like it's cracking.
Whoa. Slow down. Testing a 22 pivot. English.
Well, okay. Over the summer into the autumn, they created a cup with handle pattern. When you look at a cup with handle pattern, for folks who don't know, if there's no handle yet, the pivot is the left side apex of the cup. Once a handle forms, you move the pivot to the right side apex of the cup. That was the $22 level for Palantir. They broke out on earnings in early February. They broke out past pivot. They got as high as 27 or so, which was our target price. And it still is. We reestablished it because it came in from there. So it hit our target. So up until that point, we had hardly ever made a mistake in the name because I had been in this name with stocks under 10 before I was allowed to own it for myself. So my price is in the teens because I wasn't able to buy it until the stocks under 10 product had ended. But our average price in stocks under 10, I think, was like $5 or something like that. So we're up a few fold in this thing. But now we got to a point where there is some profit taking. There's a mini, maybe 2 month head and shoulders pattern, which is a slightly bearish pattern forming right now. So the stock is coming in. There's a gap that needs to trade between 20 all the way down to 18 or so to fill. Now that gap may need to fill. We know that gaps don't always fill, but we know they usually do. So if that gap fills, we'll satisfy everything. It'll graze the 200-day simple moving average. This is what I see when I'm playing that three-dimensional chess nonsense we were talking about. It will graze the 200-day simple moving average, and that is where the professional money will jump on this thing. And that's where I think I will add down to that because I don't know if I'm precise on my levels here. But that is where I think the professionals will jump in with both fists, and that's where I will increase more. This is a name that I am trying to build a very large long position in, and I'm looking at it as something that I can leave to generations of Guilfoyles when I'm gone.
Are there generations of Guilfoyles?
Well, there's the one that I created. The one after that is still under construction.
TBD. So, Sarge, not to put a too fine a point on it, you're saying the gap is 18 to 20, and you know, you said at that lower level it would graze the 200-day moving average.
Right now, yeah, right now where the 200-day simple moving average is $18.20. So
okay, but if you're the average investor, not a trader, or at least not an active investor, where you're sitting there like we do, watching the market, watching the tick and the tack, you might say, hey, put an alert in. You know, 2021. Maybe you start if you're creating a new position, average down if as you get closer to that, especially if that support level holds. Is that kind of your advice? If you were still doing stocks under 10, would that be something you would say?
I probably would tell the retail trader who's doing something else occupationally, so they're not focused on this 24/7, to enter what we would call a scale order, mm-hmm. a GTC mm-hmm. scale order, good till cancel scale order, so that you buy, I don't know, buy a little bit every 50 cents or every 25 cents on the way down until you have enough shares out that you know how many shares you want to buy approximately and how much you want to pay for it. So you scale it from, let's say, 22 down to 18, and where you meet that dollar amount that you're willing to invest in this name.
Excellent.
And don't go over that, because then you screw yourself up.
All right. Sarge, we only have a couple minutes left. And when we had Carly on, she gave us three wonderful places to visit in Las Vegas. With Helene Meisler, you know, we talked a little bit about St. Louis Custard and Ted Drew's. But with you, I know that you traverse back and forth between New York and Florida, dual offices, dual homes there. Any standout places along the way? And I'm not talking beautiful rest stops.
Well, the Francis Key Bridge, I think, is out now. But
correct. Correct. But,
okay, Washington D.C. during the cherry blossom season, which is really only late March or early April, they bloom a different time every year. That's really a spectacular sight to see, if you don't mind going into the city down there and checking out the sites. You'll need a day or two, so it's not just part of your drive down to Florida if you're trying to make time, but it's something to see on your, as you mosey down I-95, if you have the time to do it. As you move into Virginia, you'll see on the side of the road, there is a building around Quantico that has, it kind of resembles a modern version of the Iwo Jima Marine Corps statue. That's the Marine Corps Museum. So you only have to get off the road much. You just have to get a few, just barely off the road, to go visit the Marine Corps Museum, which is a really nice thing to see. It's for folks who have been in the military who don't really know much about the Marine Corps. It's on a par with the Infantry Museum at Fort Benning from an Army perspective. So it's a really outstanding museum. And you know, if you've got a wife and kids in the car who don't care about that sort of thing, as you enter Florida, the Welcome Center in Florida, it's a great place to stretch legs, because they give you free orange juice and grapefruit juice.
I like the plug for Florida. I also like the fact that you're trying to naturally sugar people up as they get in there. Probably a little juice, no pun intended, for the final leg of the ride. Okay. All right. Well, Sarge, I will say, you're 100% right on the cherry blossoms. I live in Northern Virginia, you know that, but I can tell you the weather has been horrible the last few days, a lot of rain. I'm not so sure we're going to have such a beautiful cherry blossom year. But as far as Quantico and the Marine Corps Museum goes, I have to agree. So those are three great suggestions. When you come back, Sarge, in a couple weeks, we're going to flip this around, and we're going to look for three great dining options on the road to Florida.
You know I'm Irish, right? I'm kind of happy with whatever they give me.
Yeah, I know. Boiled meat and potatoes. I get it. But you know what? You know what? Mrs. Sarge will thank me for asking these questions. So we'll see what happens. All right, Sarge. Hey, all kidding aside, thank you so much for joining us. And folks, listen, you got to read Sarge every morning. Market Recon, make it on your must list. Also, follow him at Sarge986 on X. That's right, the platform formerly known as Twitter. That is our podcast today. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with you soon.